This is the Stacking the Benefits of Clean Energy breakout session. Clean energy provides affordable, emission-free electricity, but the agricultural, environmental, and health benefits can go much further. From the environmental perspective, the shift away from fossil-based generation and toward wind and solar power is part of a larger imperative to decarbonize the economy and tackle climate change. The panel includes Alex Bosmoski of Republic N, Rob Davis of Fresh Energy, Samantha Williams of Natural Resources Defense Council, and the moderator is Heather Allen of Renew Wisconsin.
So one last thing I just wanted to touch on is the environmental benefits as well of switching over from fossil fuels to renewables. We tend to think about this in NRDC in terms of the carbon emissions cuts and then the climate change benefits. What are we going to see across the Midwest as a result of mitigating climate change impacts? So I would encourage folks, if you haven't already seen it, to take a look at the fourth edition of the National Climate Assessment. It came out just before the new year. It was drafted by 13 federal agencies, and it has a Midwest section that's very detailed and documents ag impacts, loss of crop yields, Great Lakes impacts, public health impacts, and the infrastructure components. But there's also, to leave you with something positive here, because I don't want to be all gloom and doom, there's also a really prominent section about how the transition to clean energy is going to be the primary strategy to start to mitigate some of these worst impacts of climate change. Thank you.
While we're getting set up here, let's see. Let's do a quick show of hands. How many people eat fruits? Fruits, okay. How many for vegetables? Keep them up. How many for the animals that eat fruits or vegetables? All right. Bacon, yep. Okay, we're in there. So that's definitely been a very unexpected and fun part of my job here running the Center for Pollinators and Energy at an energy policy organization based in Minnesota called Fresh Energy. We very, very, very much want to accelerate the transition to use of clean and renewable energy, deployment of large-scale solar, deployment of all kinds of renewable energies. And so we're really interested in tactics that can help accelerate the rate of growth for renewables. And one of those tactics is to find and cultivate interesting new allies. However, we all love food. And so that's a really common thing that we all love. So we think about how can we engage people to talk more about food and less about wonky technology. So unfortunately, the public, when they think of solar, they get a notice that a solar farm's proposed down the road, or they read about it in the media, or they see it, God help us, on Facebook. Then they think of stuff like this. You know, they're usually approached regarded large-scale solar about projects that don't exactly have something that's there for them. It's very technology specific. It's all about the glass and the steel and the silicon and the clean energy. And isn't this great? And they just think, well, that clean energy is going somewhere else. What does this really do for me? And then they look at what's under the panels. And these are projects that are, you know, fairly recent. And they either think, what is the solar doing to the land? Or they think, my God, we're taking productive, high-quality farmland and covering it with gravel or ditch mix turf grass. So we saw this challenge because we passed some clean energy policy in Minnesota back in 2013. We had about 40 megawatts statewide. We knew we were going to scale to a couple thousand megawatts. And so we did some research because we heard from some of our donors, what the heck are you guys doing? Shouldn't all of this solar be on rooftops? And of course, we need a ton of rooftop solar, but we also need a ton of ground mount. So, you know, if you Google search solar and biodiversity, you'll find out that in the United Kingdom and in a lot of places in Europe, First Solar and other big companies are doing this kind of biodiversity-sensitive solar development, where they're establishing perennial low-growing meadows of flowering plants under and around the panels. It's a really interesting strategy that actually reduces and saves long-term O&M costs because you're only mowing once a year. And there's a lot of people. I mean, obviously everyone in this room is really passionate about solar, but there's a lot of other people who don't give a rip about clean energy, and they don't give a rip about solar. What they care about is the bees, or the birds, or the soil, or the things that interact with those species. So, what was highlighted in Utility Dive story this summer was a story of how a local rural electric cooperative went to their town planning commission and said, hey, we'd like to build a solar farm in town here and inject a couple $1 million of development. And the planning commission leaned back and was like, whoa, let's talk about the glare. Let's talk about the EMF. Let's talk about, we had plans for this land to be turned into subdivisions. We're not sure if this is an appropriate use of this land. And if you've been in a solar permitting siting hearing, you know there's all kinds of crazy that comes out of those things. People say, I recorded the sound from that solar farm and I played it for my dog. Solar kills dogs. This is what someone said. A bank vice president, she said the solar byproducts are going to leach into the soil, kill all the vegetation, and pollute the groundwater just like in Flint, Michigan. What? So what we know is that the public, unfortunately, isn't really paying attention to solar. We are, but the public isn't really paying attention. So we know that solar can be designed and sited in lots and lots of different ways. People, unfortunately, get kind of obsessed about the siting side and say, oh, yeah, solar's great. It should go somewhere else. Yeah, no, not here. No. Well, in the desert. And of course, the desert folks say, no, it should go on previously disturbed lands, and so on. So when you just think about designing solar differently, moving the panels up a couple of inches, doing a diverse mix of plants under and around the panels, then all of a sudden you go from a turf grass condition, like you see kind of in the middle of the slide here, with 6-inch roots, to a biodiverse regenerative system that's building topsoil, sequestering carbon, capturing stormwater, and infiltrating it directly on site into the aquifer. That's a pretty great system. So solar designs make a significant difference. We're actually even seeing there's a really strong economic case to say that if you push the panels a little higher, you're actually reducing the incidence of not just mower solar collisions, because when mowers hit solar panels, that's bad, but you're actually, for the one time a year that mower has to go through, you're allowing them to drive at 6 miles an hour instead of at 2 miles an hour. So if you've got 1,000 acres to quickly mow once a year, you can get it done 2 or 3 or 4 times faster. So there's really significant operational savings associated with the strategy. I want to call out this fantastic local company you guys have, and I drink certainly a lot of their milk, and a lot of my daughter eats so much of their cheese. Oh my gosh. Organic Valley is developing a network of 10 community solar farms, solar projects across Wisconsin and in southwest Minnesota. They are using science-based standards to inform what goes in under and around the vegetation. You see, when we, Fresh Energy, saw we were going to scale from, a few megawatts to a whole bunch of megawatts, our first call was to a MacArthur Genius Award-winning, TED Talk, 2.5 million views on TED Talk, pollination and honeybee scientist. And we said, hey, we're going to get a couple thousand acres of solar. Is this interesting at all? And she said, hey, look, local, state, and federal money to date is not enough to keep these species alive. And she's not just talking about the honeybee. She's talking about all of the native pollinators, the monarch butterfly, the native birds that need native grasses and flowers to eat those insects. All of the invertebrates need more healthy habitat. And so she said, anything we can do to unlock private sector investment in high quality habitat is urgently needed and welcome. Oh, okay, so this is important. So it's great to see that Organic Valley isn't telling us what's good for bees, and their solar developer, One Energy Renewables, is not telling us what's good for bees. They're relying on entomologists, some of the world's foremost experts. Are there any MacArthur Genius Award-winning honeybee scientists in the room? No. I'm not either. And don't ask me, what's good for bees. I'll say, ask Marla Spivak. She has a fantastic TED Talk. And she's introduced me and Fresh Energy to all of her friends and colleagues. and we've had productive conversations about how to design seed mixes and plans for solar farms so that you're understanding that this is first and foremost an energy generation facility. First and foremost. But man, if that seed mix can be incrementally better for pollinators without blowing up the finances of the project, well, that's an extraordinary opportunity that captures the public's imagination. People love monarchs and they love bees and they love saving the bees. And if we can save the bees while saving the planet with clean energy, that's exciting. So I also want to give a shout out to this little startup, Xcel Energy. So in the fall of this year, they chimed in as well. And so it was not just Organic Valley and their cohort peers like Aveda and Cliff Bar, but it's also Xcel Energy who's saying, hey, for every bid in our solar RFP process moving forward, and they're going to provision more than 3,000 megawatts of solar by 2030, we're going to require disclosure. We're going to ask all of those bids to include a completed copy of the Minnesota Pollinator-Friendly Solar Scorecard. It's a simple and flexible tool that doesn't say you have to use this seed mix. It's like a one-page document that says, here's different things you can do that are good for bees. So it's flexible, tons of flexibility, so it is suitable for the southwestern corner of Minnesota where we have prickly pear cactus and coyotes, or the northern boreal forests. So there can be pollinator-friendly solar farms throughout that kind of diversity. And it certainly applies here in Wisconsin, which I'm thrilled to report. This is with Dairyland. And so NG, who's got is an exhibitor here today, they developed a fantastic portfolio of solar projects for Dairyland. And so this is resulting in significantly increased customer engagement with the co-ops. They're saying, when you do one of these solar pollinator projects, you get some unanticipated consequences, like people want to come in and see it, and then they want to pay their bill, so we're having to buy more coffee. People take pride in the way that their co-ops and their utilities are developing renewable energy. And who can blame them when projects look like this? Mm-hmm. Oh, well, maybe. Maybe. There we go. So imagine playing this and sharing this with a county commission, a county planner, and members of the public before you go in to say, hey, I'd like to build a solar farm. Fear goes way down and the public support goes way up. And it's an opportunity to reach out and talk to beekeepers, talk to pheasant hunters, folks who are really excited about habitat and don't really care about corn. And talk to all kinds of people and school kids and churches, folks that this captures their imagination in the way that the glass and the steel and the silicon does not. Thank you.
That was really cool.
I didn't even get to beer.
That was really neat, Rob.
You inspire me, man. It's your Teddy Rooseveltness.
Teddy Rooseveltness. It's true that my wife and daughter and I currently live in the swamp, but I am from Wisconsin, and one of the reasons that I love coming back here, especially to engage with the doers in clean energy, is because you are doers. There's doers in this room. There are people that are doing amazing things, and it's fun to leave the talkers and get to learn from the doers. So thank you all for what you're doing and to advance clean energy in this state, my state, and give me pride in things that I can go talk about in the swamp. But the truth is that we at RepublicEN.org, we don't spend a lot of time in D.C. Have to be there for various reasons, but we spend most of our time out in the heartland talking to conservatives and Republicans and enfranchising them in climate action. So this is what we do at RepublicEN.org. We're the only, as far as I know, and we've been doing this for 7 years, so I'm pretty sure, grassroots conservative climate action organization. And we find lots of, if I had a PowerPoint, but I don't because it made Heather really happy that we didn't have to have, I wasn't going to talk for a long time. I usually just have to say, I'm a conservative, I work on climate action, and sit down and plenty of people have questions. If I did, though, I would show you, you know, I could show you charts that really look optimistic, that, you know, that climate action in and concern over climate change and stewardship are popular in this country across all segments. That majorities of Republicans and supermajorities of young ones and women and minorities and moms, moms, millennials, minorities, that's usually the three M's of the groups that the party is hemorrhaging and that actually care about climate change, and but that the majorities support it. The problem is, of course, that that doesn't apply to the most politically active component of the right side of the aisle, and those are the most powerful people. And it also doesn't apply to the influencers and to talk radio and to, you know, Bob Murray and his collection of, you know, organizations that shill for his interest. He's the Murray Energy coal guy. Throws a lot of money into hoaxerism. But what I want to convey here and then sit down and hear what you guys want to talk about is that the long game, like Sam, Samantha, do you go by Sam or Samantha?
Either one's fine.
Sam was saying, it has to go beyond the power sector. I mean, the reason we're motivated to the urgency of action for deploying clean energy is because of the urgency of action required to stem the tide of climate disruption and to reduce the worst risks. So we have to go beyond the power sector, and to do that means that we have to build non-traditional constituencies that care about climate action, not just the least controversial like part of the solution to climate action. And I think that a lot of folks in here work in that least controversial part of the solution. I mean, it's off the charts, the support for clean energy advancement, for federal engagement and advancement of clean energy, for subsidies for renewables. Honestly, it's remarkable the public support on both sides or all sides. I really envy it. I mean, it makes me jealous. Honestly, I work on climate. We speak to like about 100 different conservative audiences every year, recruiting new conservatives that care about climate, and you thought that some of those myths that Rob is encountering are funny. maybe that would be a fun book to write, just like things that we've heard on the road. So I envy that, and that is a huge asset. The fact that people intuitively understand, for various reasons that like are personal to them, why they care about having more access to clean energy. We need that to apply to climate action writ large. We need that to be a motivating force for Americans to want this country or their state and their community to be part of the solution, to be leading the innovation that invents and deploys and commercializes and sells to the rest of the world the new technologies, not just the existing ones, the new technologies that will be needed to change the IEA projection that we have 80% primary energy from fossils today and we're going to have the same 80% in 30 years. Like, we need more buy-in from non-traditional constituencies, and we're not getting it right now. It's slowly creeping up, not fast enough, through the hard lessons of experiences, which are a harsh teacher, and with all the disasters and everything, it's starting to become a more salient issue, but slowly. It's still like number 19 out of 20, and like whenever you ask for people to rank like issue importance, and even among the Republicans that care, it's a lower salience than on the other side. So how do we do that? And I think that it's important. I'll just mention quick a couple things, ways that we can do that, and see what irritates you enough to want to ask a question about. Firstly, policy. And policy that's broad and fair climate policy, not just parochial or specific to a specific industry, even though on the short term those specific industry policies might be easier to get through or to get through with insider baseball in the Capitol without having to like engage with a huge public backlash. And we work a lot on carbon pricing, on fair, transparent, predictable, and return where revenues are returned to taxpayers and border adjustments keep American competitiveness intact, carbon taxes. Carbon tax is not extraordinarily popular when you poll it right now, but when you, if you have a minute with pretty much any philosophy, it is a policy that can bring people together. And when you have the power sector only responsible for 30% of the country's emissions, and we need to innovate in all the sectors, a policy that applies an innovation signal across the entire economy is extraordinarily powerful, not for the immediate substitution effect, which would be small, but for the long-term product cycles and the substitution over the long haul and the signal for innovation. And the fact that it allows renewable energy especially to say, we don't want special treatment, we want a level playing field. I saw on Twitter, but didn't see it this morning, that Ellen Nowak said that renewable energy should be dictated by the economics and the market, not by mandates. I'm sure that some folks thought, you know, were irritated by that, but you can play in that jungle. Like that should be A-okay with everyone in this room. If we have an actual fair playing field, true free enterprise, our products win. And that's true. We need a real level playing field. That's what you want. And that's what a carbon tax can help effectuate. And it would be wonderful to have more coalitional support across the oh my goodness. I already hit 8 minutes?
Yeah.
Okay, can I have 30 seconds? I thought I was going to just sit down right away. It's carbon taxes. Let's talk about them. messengers. People, this is the most important way to get your message across. It's not always what you say. It is who's saying it. And there needs to be more enfranchising of people that are credible to those non-traditional constituencies. If anyone doesn't know, like Scott Conan and the Wisconsin Conservative Energy Forum folks, I mean, that's a great place to start, but there's we need to diversify our messengers and think about, have long-term investment in the field, not like some of the triage that sometimes the utility companies will play, like when there's a PUC case coming up and like a huge investment comes in to try to engage everyone, including Republicans and conservatives, a lot of money comes in and then everyone leaves. And then there's no watering of the grassroots and they wither. Like, we need long-term investment to keep these coalitions together. And then disentangling from the left. You guys, the renewable energy industry has not suffered this defeat yet, but it is dangerous times ahead here. With the Green New Deal and this 100% renewables in 10-year stuff that's getting bundled together with no market mechanisms, no nuclear, like redistribution, 70% marginal tax rate. You just hear this stuff being spouted off in the same sentence as renewables. Be careful. Like, we have 20 years ago, climate change was more accepted as a consensus scientific view among Republicans than among Democrats. Like, that changed when it became part of a basket of progressive issues. And it doesn't need to be. This can be a standalone, multi-coalitional, across the parties problem that we're addressing as Americans. As you run into trouble, and I'm worried about that wonderful, overwhelming support among the public in renewable energy if it becomes entangled with the politics of some of this Green New Deal stuff. Thanks.
Well, thank you to our speakers. It's a wonderful continuum of things that we have swirling around as we think about renewable energy and the future of renewable energy. So I would like to open this up to the audience to see what questions may have generated during the conversations that we have. Yes, and our volunteer will bring the mic to you.
This question is for Rob. I know that getting pollinator-type vegetation going is not as easy as it looks. Can you tell us a little bit about the process that utilities are using and companies are using to get that going and have it be successful not only at the beginning but on an ongoing basis? Thank you.
Absolutely. A very simple tool called a contract. So when utilities or solar power owners, solar site owners, sign a performance contract with a vegetation expertise, a vegetation expert, a landscape company. So here in Wisconsin, you have Applied Ecological. In Minnesota, we have Minnesota Native Landscapes and Prairie Restorations. So there's all kinds of competing firms that have 20, 30, 40 years of expertise, deep and successful expertise in bringing back, you know, landscapes, managed but pollinator-friendly landscapes. So, you know, I mean, the trouble people get in is that, unfortunately, when you're building a brand new solar farm, the vegetation is usually less than 1% of the total project budget. And so because it's such a tiny piece of the budget, people assign that a level of importance. And they're just like, oh, I don't care about the vegetation. I'm not thinking about the vegetation. It's not even important. It must not be. So they just hire, you know, their brother, their brother's brother. I know a guy, he's got a truck and a couple of bags of seed. Well, it doesn't go well, right? So if you take an approach where you're like, oh, I know how to plant pollinator seed, and you open a seed packet and throw it out, that's, you can expect what you're going to get. But there are experts out there that know how to do this. At Fresh Energy's website, the URL beeslovesolar.org will take you right to a link with more than 8 hours of in-depth training on how to establish native plant communities, pollinator-friendly plant communities, whether native or non-native, under and around solar farms. So there's expertise out there. Hire the experts.
And there's another resource I'd like to mention. I know that Fresh Energy worked with the University of Wisconsin and Renew Wisconsin to come up with a pollinator scorecard for Wisconsin. So folks doing solar in Wisconsin have a checklist that reflects our native habitat and provides information. You can just Google that, and that's available. Yes, I think we have a question in the back.
Thank you. And I just want to add to what Rob said. There's also another website, ruralsolarstories.org, which has also got examples of pollinator-friendly planning. But I would like to respond to Mr. Bosmoski, and I'll try to put it in the form of a question at some point. He was saying that that renewables need to disentangle from the left, and that, you know, we're at this problem with climate change being so loaded because of the left. And I would suggest instead we need to entangle more at the right and just build all the support we can. And I guess the question would be how you regard the work of, like, say, the Koch brothers, you know, who are, like, basically the third largest or maybe second largest political party, perhaps in terms of power in the country. I mean, right here in Wisconsin, you know, they came to Wisconsin, and I have this from Dale Schultz, you know, and they really changed a lot of our politics. And underlying that all was, you know, stripping away environmental protections and so forth. And I've got a bunch of other questions for you. Maybe we can have a beer at the end of the day. Oh, great. He gets one.
There's pollinator beer.
but you know, I mean, don't you recognize that those terms have been intentionally demonized? And I mean, that's, I wish the left had the power. I'm a little left. But, you know, don't you think they had an impact?
Okay, I'll just keep this on here. So I should clear up what I was rushing to say there. I didn't mean to suggest that renewable energy is entangled. Climate change, climate action is. So to achieve the level of support that we have for renewable energy broadly, we need to disentangle climate change from, like, the orthodoxy that considers it to be part of the purview of the left. I was just suggesting that I'm worried about the salability and broad support of renewables if the same thing happens that happened to climate action. So it was a worry, not a accusation. Yes, I totally go up against the Koch infrastructure, the Hydra of organizations all the time. There's been some improvement on, you know, how much they care about climate change. I mean, even from the very top, say, like, they're the Koch brothers themselves are not hoaxers anymore. But the organizations, yeah, they're certainly not helping. Look, there's just, what's amazing about stopping something is that it takes a lot less effort than getting something done. I mean, this state knows that. So I forget what the other part of your question was.
Okay, let's take another question from the audience. Thank you very much. We have one over on this side. Our volunteers got the microphone. Or you can shout it out. Sounds like a question for Samantha.
To reduce fossil fuel subsidies?
On the production level, and things like, not subsidies specifically, but zero raise in gas tax for the, last 30 years in Wisconsin. Mm. I know there were a fair amount of subsidies that went to the oil majors in the States. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Frankly, I don't see much of that changing on the production side anytime soon, unfortunately. I think on the renewable side, we were talking this morning with the policy panel about subsidies and support for the renewables industry, given that is, I believe the analogy was still in its pubescence, the teenage years. And I would certainly not want to see us let our feet off the gas on that anytime soon either. And I guess I'll kind of take the subsidy question and transition it to my own screed about mandates and about policy, about need for strong state and local policy to make sure that renewables keep moving forward. And half the states that I work in the Midwest are not MISO states, they're PJM states. And if you look at the PJM renewables queue, it looks a lot different than that MISO renewables queue. There's not as much renewables being built just based on market forces in Illinois and in Ohio, and particularly in a place like Ohio, it's all natural gas plants. And you see very few renewables being built. So I think we still need to keep the subsidies that we have for renewables. I would call them more support, market support, policy support, but also make sure that we are expanding RPSs as much as we can and other incentives. It's gonna be needed. And also, diversifying RPSs too, so that they're not just utilities collecting RECs, which may not develop renewables in your state, but there is some creative policy solutions developed in Illinois over the last few years to make sure that large-scale renewables are being built right within the state of Illinois. But it's also about distributed generation. There's a REC market for DG that came directly from the RPS. Half of the RPS is all distributed, which also includes community solar, and making sure that low-income people have access to solar as well. So I sort of went far afield from your original question, but hopefully answered that.
Can I just add one thing, which is that the biggest subsidy in the whole energy market is free pollution for the fossil industry. And if I was in charge of SEIA or was a renewable energy communicator or some lobbyist or something, I would be up there telling all the Republicans, we want to get rid of all the subsidies. Like, we can compete. We'll win in a truly free market. But that means that they can't get free pollution and they can't get preferential lease terms and preferential accelerated depreciation. But we can compete if they just don't get free pollution. I would spin it like that.
That would really help on the natural gas side, too. There's still carbon emissions coming from natural gas-fired power. And internalizing the externalities of carbon might actually get us there to level the playing field. And maybe we wouldn't need RPSs at that point. We haven't modeled that out, but I think it's sort of a provocative question. If you did, level the playing field with the social cost of carbon, could you get there without state policies further putting the thumb on the scale?
I'll just, like, seven or six, five, 6 years ago, the renewable energy folks, at least at the trade associations, didn't like the trade. Like, if there's a $30 carbon tax rising at a certain amount and we get rid of the ITC, we don't like it. I have heard very few or none of those protests anymore. So I think, I guess I don't have the model either, but it sure seems like the costs have come down that to a point where the trade is now much more palatable to the renewable energy industry.
Okay, we're actually at time, but I'm going to allow for one more question, and then afterward, folks should go back across the hall for the next scaling up panel, which will be really interesting. But maybe our panelists can stay for anybody who wants to have, ask a couple questions after the panel breaks up. Okay, so one last question.
All right, quickly, Al here. I'm with the Waukesha County Green Team, and I also work for Sunrun. The FDIC is super if you get money. Doesn't help the poor people do it. The subsidies that this country has done for the betterment of all, roads, rural electrification, what have you, we had leadership, we bought in, and we did that because it was the betterment for all of us. What do we need to do to get stewardship forefront ahead of money?
Isn't that the big question? Does anyone want to weigh in?
You go, Rob.
That's tough.
Yeah.
That's tough. I mean, keep saying it, keep asking the question again and again and again. And you'll be surprised who you find, coming back and saying, yeah, that's an interesting priority. I was delighted. I'm going to be back in the driving through Wisconsin again. On my way to Pheasant Fest at the end of February. So there'll be a panel all about pollinator and pheasant-friendly solar. And so they see opportunities. As an organization, they see opportunities to look past the technology and look at the stewardship that's going on the ground. And so that's really encouraging to me. And if we as a group of environmentalists can find common ground with, a group of America's largest pheasant hunting sporting organization and conservation organization, there's hope. And I'm optimistic about that.
I think that's a perfect way to end the conversation. So thank you all for being here today, and thank you to our panelists.